Welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. I've been looking forward to this show all week. I was out last night and someone said, what's your topic? And I said, oral history. And this woman who was sitting next to him said, what's that got to do with wildlife? I said, I don't think very much. And she said, well, every time I listen to your show, it's about ducks and bears. So I thought it was a nature program. It's not. We're going to talk about oral history. With me in the studio are some oral historians. Bill Schneider, the curator of oral history with the Arctic Polar Regions area of our University of Alaska Library System. John Whitehead, who is a professor of history. And Jean Lister, who is... Lester. Hi. I just have a mental block about that. I'm sorry, Jean.
It's okay.
Jean Lester, who is presently very involved in doing an oral history project. I think, that we need to talk about the field of oral history a little bit and set the stage and do a little background about how we gather history, what makes history, what constitutes it. I will throw it open to any of you, but Bill, would you like to start and tell us about oral history as a field?
Sure. As you were talking about the birds and the bees, no, I guess it was the ducks and the wildlife.
Ducks and the bears.
Ducks and the bears. I was thinking about the fact that really oral history is about human nature. And
well, then this is a nature program.
So this is a nature program, and we're very natural. But really, oral history is what happens when we take time to listen carefully to what people have to say around us. And by that, I mean being rather selective, too. And I don't mean that we just randomly listen to everything, because we can't do that. We've only got so much energy and so much talent. But oral history is what happens when we carefully listen to what folks have to say, and when we realize the importance of what they have to say and make some decisions about how we're going to preserve that record, whether we're going to preserve it in our own minds and just remember and think back about it, whether we're going to preserve it on a tape, or whether we're going to preserve it in a written form or a radio show. So that's not the way oral historians generally define oral history, but that's the way I'd like to define it this morning.
Okay. Most of us, thinking back to our high school or college history courses, think of it as, well, I'm going to date myself as usual, think of it as memorizing a long series of dates and changes in government and military maneuvers. And we were talking a little bit before the show that kind of history is gathered in general from documents, from official acts, and from the diaries and behaviors and so on, well documented, of very famous people with some power. That seems to be changing in the last, I don't know, you tell me. John?
Well, at some levels it is changing, though I don't think you would find that the high school experience of people today is much different from it was in your time. Most of my students in the university tell me that history was their least favorite subject in high school, whether they took it last year or 30 years ago, this memorization aspect of trivia or minute details is still a heavy aspect in a lot of the teaching. And I think we would find that dull, whether it was the history of great events or the history of what went on around the block. Mm-hmm. But in general, in the broader sense of what takes place in the historical profession over the last few years, or maybe I should say the last few decades, there's been a clear move away from attention solely at national history or what took place in Washington, D.C. Many people don't feel that they relate to that, or that the group they come from or they feel attached to had any part of that. So there's clearly been a much broadening of what kinds of history you can study. We would note this probably in our curriculum most clearly in the courses looking at people who have not been inside the movers and shakers world, or who feel they've been excluded, for example, women's studies or minority studies. Mm-hmm. More and more people want to study who they are and the group they're affiliated with, rather than some people out in the distance who they don't feel they have access to. So there's clearly been a great broadening of history. And also, there's been a broadening of techniques. A lot of people don't enjoy going into a dusty, musty library and poring over papers. A lot of people want to get out and meet the people who are making history. And I think oral history has been particularly appealing because people, whether they're high and mighty or low and lowly, don't always write down everything they do. And also, if I think oral history as a technique has become popular because people don't like memorizing details. Regardless of what the subject of the history is, if it's presented as a story, and it can be the story of your hometown or the story of the world, if it's presented as a story with drama and excitement, people like it. And oral history tends to be a storytelling.
Has an immediacy.
It can be dull. I mean, we've all heard Aunt Sue recite for the 18th time what she did when she was a girl, and that can be as boring as who was president in 1820. But in general, oral history tends to have this storytelling, dramatic, theatrical quality to it, which makes it very appealing.
More palatable way, excuse me, a more palatable way of accessing
and
the past.
And I think most of us, some people could enjoy nothing less than curling up with a book or a pack of newspapers, but I think in general, an average class of people would rather go out and meet somebody and acquire history that way rather than through totally non-living sources.
Well, and in fact, all the past has not been recorded in letters and papers.
That's correct.
It has struck me several times when you read the journals of famous people or huge volumes, three successive volumes come out by someone of all of their letters and all of their correspondence, and I had a sense that they must have known they were going to be famous so that they saved all of this supporting documentation, because I have no sense that I'm going to be famous, and if I ever inadvertently became famous, my paper background is real scrappy. I've thrown out most of my letters, lost in various moves, and I'm not a journal keeper, and so on. So,
but we do have the record of your radio show. Is that correct, Patty?
And
I think that's perhaps one of the most revealing statements of your personality. I knew a lot about you before I met you this week.
Or so you thought.
Or so I thought.
I don't know. As a matter of fact, that is a curious thing that occurs around having this radio show. Is I meet people who have heard it for a long time and have some fairly extensive sense of me, and I have none of them. I feel really disadvantaged in that context.
You know, the neat thing about that is that people are in their homes for the most part. I guess it was Saturday night when you used to have the show, and now it's Saturday morning. People are in their homes. They're very comfortable, and it's at comfortable hours that they're hearing this, and so you're reaching them in a very palatable way, and that reminds me of Jean's program and how she reaches people, because she reaches them in those comfortable ways.
I was just thinking, I think that makes a real difference, too, is where and how you're approaching people. Just before we got on the air, this is the first time I've met John. I've known Bill for a long time. And he was saying he was working on a project of the movers and shakers. And the first thing I said was, I guess I'm working sort of on the opposite thing. But then I thought, no, I think I'm working on the real movers and shakers, because I'm working on the people that are just the ordinary spectrum that we meet every day that I think really form our society. And forgive me, John, because this is obviously just an opinion. The bright lights that make the dates and the events are one thing, but really society is shaped by the average person and how he or she goes through their life and the decisions they make and why they make these decisions. And I'm trying to record that. And I record that in the comfort of their home, I think, or whether by the time they know me as an individual.
Well, do you go for the exciting common people or the dull plotters?
I've never found anybody that I thought was dull.
I guess. Is that the first sign of an oral historian? I feel quite the same way.
No, quite the contrary. I'd like to disagree with both of you. I think you do some selection, and I think you do too, because physically and mentally we just can't take it all in. So we do some natural selecting, and Gene, I would suggest that your selection is based in part upon your artistic ability.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, my main selection is what people look like. It's not ridiculous. I like people with big noses or big ears or beards or relatively different looking faces. And then when I get to the oral history, I mean, that's secondary.
In fact, this is probably a very good place for us to ask you about your project. Could you...
Well, I fell into this oral history very accidentally. We were doing this project of 25 faces of 84, trying to preserve a spectrum of the population in the sense that you preserve historic buildings, etc.
And this had to do with our celebration?
Yes.
25th year of Alaska.
A spin-off of that. That's where the idea came from.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question naturally arose, here you've got these 25 people. People are going to say, well, why did you choose these people? I mean, here you've got this painting, and people are going to want to know about them. So therefore, we came into this idea of doing a short biography. And I'd known Bill for years, and I first thought of somebody else doing the biography, but then knowing what a critical person I was, that if they didn't get what I thought was the essence of that person, the poor soul, I would be very critical. So
their faces and learning something about their personality.
Yeah.
From the visual.
Well, I think what really happens there is when you paint someone, you're very vulnerable. I'm very vulnerable. Painting is a magic thing. It doesn't always work. And, you know, they see me as a human being. I'm not this magical person up there able to create this thing. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't, or to a greater or lesser degree. So by the time we finish the painting, we know each other a lot better. Mm-hmm. I'm not a very threatening person, and therefore... an element of trust has been established.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't go in cold. So when I go in to tape, we're already friends. We
mm-hmm.
know each other.
What media do you use?
I use oil.
Oil.
Mm-hmm.
There's something I think quite compelling and sort of major about having an oil painting done of yourself. We are very accustomed to snapshots, pictures. We know that we can change, but there's something that really fixes your face in time when you have an oil painting done of you, and there's a lot of interpretive room there,
mm-hmm.
and I think some of us are surprised to hear how our voices sound recorded. Certainly mine sounds different to me than it does in my head, and I think the same thing's true with a painting of someone. They may have a feeling of how they look or how they come across, and you may capture something very different.
I think one of the most exciting things that happens to me is when somebody looks at the painting and they say, oh, that's just how I feel,
uh-huh.
rather than just how I think I look, because then it means you've somehow...
whether they like it or not.
Yeah, you've captured the essence of them, which is what you're trying to do, and I try to do the same thing in the oral histories. I'm not interested in dates and events. I'm interested in how they felt about their life, how they related to their fellow human beings, from the family, nucleus of the family, right to the extended family of society.
So you're an oral sociologist.
Am I? Okay, that's what I, yes, I am, that's what I'm interested in very much. And the fact that everybody makes a contribution, I think everybody's very important.
What is the difference between sociology and history?
Well, I think, among other things, are you interested in knowing what they've done over a period of time, or... how
yes.
they related any one moment to each other.
Well, yes, how they viewed their life, what they've done over a period of time, why they made the decisions they made, what they thought, if they thought, or had time enough to think, or as they reflect back what they felt was most important, or how they saw themselves fitting into society, and all these things.
Okay, as opposed to how they fit into public events.
Oh, absolutely, yes, I don't even...
I mean, you're not interested in... what they were doing on the day of Pearl Harbor?
No.
Okay. The historian would probably be more interested in how did the individual relate
to
public events,
mm-hmm.
whereas you're probably more interested in how the individual relates to his private or personal life.
Yes, because I see that we are all sort of political in the sense of just our life is a statement
mm-hmm.
of what we believe. And so in that way of, no, I'm not interested in what they were doing on Pearl Harbor Day. I'm interested in what they were thinking when events happened in their family or by the...
Well,
see, because in our oral history that Bill and I did, which was a history of the Alaska statehood movement,
mm-hmm.
What we were interested in was interviewing people who had put together the Constitution of the state of Alaska. So our concern was how these individuals related to this great public event,
mm-hmm.
rather than generally how they felt about being in Alaska or something yeah. like that.
Right. Their impact and their involvement in the statehood convention mm-hmm. and the writing of the Constitution and so on.
Yeah.
Maybe take a minute and talk about your Bill Egan interview. I think that's a good one. The context and how that happened.
Oh, when we were doing the oral history of Alaska statehood, we wanted to interview Bill Egan, obviously, because he'd been president of the convention and the first governor. And we were told by friends it was very difficult to get in touch with Bill, that everyone wanted to interview him, and as a result, he didn't grant many interviews. So through his one of his former assistants, Trudy Kane, who's now an aide to Bill Sheffield here in Fairbanks, Trudy arranged for me to go down and talk with Governor Egan down in Anchorage, and when I got in touch with him, he was always an early riser, wanted to know if I could be there at 6, but fortunately had a breakfast meeting that morning, and told me he could give me 30 seconds. So I got there. He told me he didn't even have time for 30 seconds. He would just give me a few thoughts, and definitely not to get out the tape recorder.
Short thoughts.
Because there wasn't time for that. Well, about 50 minutes later, I left his office because he had one more thing that was important.
Did you ignore his admonition and get out your tape recorder initially?
No, because I kept fearing that if he saw the tape recorder coming out, he would say, well, I don't have time for that. That's all mm-hmm. I have to say. But I would watch him very carefully as he opened, as he took the cap off of his fountain pen.
Uh-huh.
Because when he put the cap back on the fountain pen, I'd figure, well, I've got about 5 more minutes. And then when he would take the cap off the fountain pen, I said, oh, gosh, well, he's going to end it now. So after I had the conversation with him, I rushed across to a coffee shop to write down everything he'd said. But it was interesting why I think he didn't want the tape recorder or didn't have time for a character who was so vital in the past of Alaska. I wouldn't say he had no interest in the past, but he had more concern with the future.
Mm-hmm.
And he was more, his energy was behind getting on with what he was doing rather than reminiscing about the past.
And maybe that's why he was so instrumental in mm-hmm. that public event.
Mm-hmm. 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 But it was interesting when I went down there, Trudy Kane had said to me, you may get 30 seconds and you may get 3 hours. Mm-hmm. And there's no way to predict. So often with the oral history, you're in these odd positions where you can't actually get the recorder on. And I've also tried talking with other people who are happier talking while they're riding in their cars than when they're mm-hmm. sitting down in the comfort of their house. And you never know when they're going to talk to you
mm-hmm.
or what they're going to say. So a lot of my oral history has not been done with a tape recorder, but listening to people and then rushing out
and
to write it down.
Writing as much as you
yeah.
can. Obviously, being an oral historian involves some real attentive and active listening skills. Could we talk a bit about the technique? What constitutes oral history? I mean, does it count what John was furiously writing down in a coffee
yeah.
shop? How does he document it? What
has As a person who spends 90% of his time taking care of things that people bring to me in the way of recordings, most of them in really bad shape, I'd like to say publicly to the world, are you listening, world?
Hello out there, the directions.
That the best oral history in the world is oral history that's listened to and not recorded. Go back later and capture those few select gems, but don't record everything that somebody says. Now, there's lots of people who disagree with me, but I'm the authority.
There have to be some
you have to be
privileges.
Selective. I mean, let's realize that we have to be selective. It's the archaeologist is selective in where he digs and what he digs. The historian is selective in what they look at. The sociologist is selective. The painter's selective. We need to be very careful about where we do our recording. We need to be open. We need to be receptive. We need to be good listeners. But we also need to take time to figure out what it is that needs to be captured and then go back and capture it.
And there's a two-way street here. All at once, the good oral historian should have some questions in mind for the person to respond to. There's nothing duller than going to someone and say, hi, let's just, you tell me the story of your life. And that just goes on forever. But on the other hand, the oral historian should be trying to find something from the person. But on the other hand, the worst of all is when you argue with your subject. Mm. I mean, to listen to a tape in which the interviewer is constantly arguing. Mm-hmm.
Saying, no, it
saying,
wasn't
no,
1904,
no,
it must
no, no, it
that.
Really wasn't that. You're totally wrong in what you're telling me. then that results in...
And that presumably would happen in a project like yours where you really have studied that whole constitutional convention in great detail. You know exactly...
Yeah, well, you might have prepared in advance some notes so that if someone tells you something that's totally at odds with the record, that you could lead them in to have them respond, but you don't want to argue with them.
So what you're saying is the oral historian is there to be a real neutral recorder of this person's perception of...
But in a way, someone who nonetheless provokes a response, not who's a total wet blanket.
Right, somebody who can extract some interesting memories or some perceptions that the person being interviewed themselves might have forgotten.
That's right.
Or might not think to mention. I've been down in the archives a bit, and there are some transcripts of oral histories taken, and some of them are just very chronological. In 1904, I arrived in Fairbanks, mm-hmm. and then we moved to a cabin in 1910, and then we did this, and then we did that.
And that's as dull as the dates of the presidents she didn't like, because it's a pioneer or an Alaskan doesn't send it up into the heaven of interest.
But I want to go back to something that Bill said before I lose this thought. We're having a conversation here, and there's a tape going. It also happens to be going out live on the air. But I don't really, in this instance, feel that it in any way is inhibiting the active listening that's going on or the conversation. Why can't you get comfortable enough with just flipping that recorder on the first time so that you can go back and not only have your own notes and what your strong memories are, but also have the accurate recording and look from that. And if you have to go back, fine, go back. But I don't see why it should be such an inhibitor, especially in this very technological age. I mean, people are getting comfortable with machines, or are they not? I mean, you tell me.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that, certainly. It depends, though, on what you want to do with the recording afterwards. I don't think we have time or money or resources or energy to take a 4-hour tape of somebody rambling where there may be 2 or 3 gems in it and pull those out. I'm speaking from an archivist standpoint.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What we want is something that's rather not concise in the sense that the person's constrained, but rather focused.
Mm-hmm.
So that when I do my research, what I like to do is listen. Let me talk about a project I'm doing with an old timer here in town, a life history. And I listened to the man for about 10 years, and I wanted to do the life history for about 8 of those 10 years. And he wouldn't agree at first, and gradually over the years he agreed. And so over a period of 2 years, I tried to get him to retell me all of the stories that related to his life that I thought were of interest. And then I'm in the process now of piecing it together and identifying gaps. And now I'll go back and try to get, in his words, descriptions of some of those missing links in the story. And so that's a very tight and focused approach. But it started with my having lots of time sitting and listening to him over a period of years. And so it just depends on where you want to go with it.
Boy, I have to interrupt here and say, may I? I certainly agree that it's awfully dull to listen to tapes of hours of rambling. But my approach is very different, because I've found that I like to have the people relaxed enough that they sort of forget about the... And they do ramble, and sometimes they get the same thing again and again, and that's why there's an enormous amount of time, which we're going to talk about, too, that involved in this. But what I find happens is the gems you get by letting them be relaxed and take their own pace are just marvelous. And it, for me, it's worth it to listen to 4 hours of tape to get...
To cut out that five minutes of...
That's right, and put it in the biography, because that to me is the essence of the person, or these little things.
But what you're talking about then is ending up with a similar product.
Yes,
you're willing to
yes.
take endless hours mm-hmm. of tape to listen and listen mm-hmm. to them, and having
right.
done some transcripts of recordings, it takes a very long time. It can take 8 hours to transcribe a 40-minute interview. But what you're saying is you're willing to take that time, go back and edit out for a concise hours discussion of really interesting things.
Also, I don't just transcribe things I've heard again and again. I just listen and think, oh, I've got that, or that isn't relevant to my project. So I transcribe things I think I'm going to use, and then I edit again.
Is this just a difference in technique, Bill, or are we talking about a philosophical difference?
It just depends on what you want to make as an archival document afterwards, what you plan to do with it afterwards. Like a radio show, when you're developing a radio show, you cut up the tape, and you boil it down to just the gems. Well, I look with horror at what may be on the floor, but then I wonder, well, where's the master going? You know, is the master going into the archives? And if the master's going into the archives, do I really want that master?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do I really want all that rambling? Because when the user comes into the archives and says, I want a recording on dog mushing, are they going to be willing to sit and listen to all that rambling?
672 mm-hmm. hours of mm-hmm. dog
yeah.
mushing discussion.
So what we're getting here, and this is real interesting, what we're getting here is a difference in the audience that we're looking for. You're shaping your own audience out of the raw tape. And what I'm saying from the standpoint of the archives is, what are we going to receive? What are we going to get that's going to be usable and accessible by people who come in to use it?
Okay, do I get the implication that once we record something, we feel very precious about it, and there is a decision that has to be made? Oh my God, this person was really instrumental. For example, mm-hmm. if you had 7 hours of Bill Egan on a recorder, let's take an example where there is some mm-hmm. real decisions to be made. You have 7 hours, hypothetically, because we know you didn't get mm-hmm. to record him at all, but you have someone of Bill Egan's importance to statehood development, 8 hours on mm-hmm. on tape, and perhaps a lot of that is rambling, and there's only 45 minutes of really excellent, to-the-point stuff. What you're saying is, do you feel compelled to save the entire 7 hours? Can you throw it on the floor and just save the 45 minutes? That's a decision you have to make as an archivist.
It's a decision that we have to make based upon a wide range of knowledge of the events and the history of the era, and it's a weighty decision. And I don't have any answers.
Okay, I think that we need to talk here about what kind of skills does one need to acquire to become even a beginning oral historian, obviously there's a skills bag here that, that needs to be developed. It isn't just having a access to an older person who's...
Oh, yes, it is.
Oh, it is.
That's what I said at the beginning, Patty. The most important skill in this whole business is an ability to listen.
Okay, but...
And you know, it happens when a child is young, and in the native traditions here, we are really conscious of the fact that stories are told in a particular way, they're told in a particular season, they're told by special people, and they're passed on in special ways. And children develop those sensitivities and become very, very conscious of it. And so a lot of that is part of the enculturation that's critical amongst the native cultures. And I think we can learn a lot about that in becoming sensitive to what are the precious things that our grandparents can tell us, or our great-grandparents, or our aunts and uncles. Now, the business of recording what you decide to record, I think if you are saying that you're going to record this and keep it for posterity, and then you use a recording device that's inadequate, or you haven't worked out any sort of agreement as to how it's going to be used later on with the person you're interviewing, then you're doing a disservice to grandma or to whoever it is. So we're very conscious of using high-quality equipment. We're very conscious of working out those legal constraints with the person so that everyone understands. Mm-hmm. But that's only when we want to preserve it for a later period.
Okay, we may have...
But get some of Gene's comments on equipment stuff, too.
Okay, first of all, I want to give our phone number because we may have all kinds of budding oral historians out there who have gone to their family reunions, recorded the whole thing, and they may have questions for you. So 474-5044. That is our number, and I encourage all of you to join in either with questions or additions to this discussion. 474-5044. Okay, Gene. Equipment.
Well, I'm starting to laugh because Bill and I have a lot of conversations about this. And a few weeks ago, he was saying, "Oh, anybody, you know, we were talking about transcribing tapes." And I said, "Oh, anybody can transcribe a tape." And he said, "Oh, that's really easy for you to say. I mean, you've been an editor and you know how to understand how language works. And so it isn't easy for everybody." And I thought, "Well, yeah, okay, maybe it isn't easy." Then when we started talking about this program just a few days ago, and he said, "Well, I'm talking about anybody can record, do oral history." And I thought, "Oh, yeah, yeah." And then I got home and I thought, "Hey, wait a minute. If you want to talk about special skills, the first thing I'd like to talk about is support systems. I could not do this without university equipment. I mean, it's expensive. It's very good equipment. I could not make that outlay without the support of the university. I also, Bill is getting paid for his oral history. I'm sure John is getting paid for his oral history. I'm not getting paid for mine. So my other support system is economic. Fortunately, my husband is saying, "It's okay, this is really important for you to do this. Go ahead and do this." But if I did not have that, I could not do oral history.
However, a lot of history has been done by amateur historians
through
the years, things that have turned...
And a lot of oral history is not done with expensive equipment. I mean, we did the Alaska Statehood Study with...
But that's one of the faults, John, of those recordings. I mean, you and I and Klaus Natzke were willing to summarize those. Mm-hmm. But when someone comes into the archives and wants to listen to those, the tape quality is variable depending on who did the recording and their care in labeling it and their care in the interview process.
Right, but
we pulled out the gems.
But actually, quality equipment, I mean, when did you do this project that you were just referring to, Bill?
1981.
But my understanding or my feeling is that equipment, really good quality equipment, is becoming more and more accessible. You know, every hobby, if you're a photographer for a hobby, it costs money. So presumably one could learn what was the best equipment for this. And certainly my little work in radio has very much sensitized me to noise in a room, to air conditioner sounds, heating sounds, and so on. So it doesn't take a very long time before you understand what technically is a bad recording situation and what is a good one. But let's presume we put the money in or borrowed the equipment. now what makes the difference between oral history and just family talking, or an interesting neighbor or a not-so-interesting neighbor talking?
Well, the difference is what... One thing I've always pointed out is that if you're a historian writing from manuscripts, the historian is creating a product.
Mm-hmm.
And with oral history, although we want to think that the people we're going to are the fascinating parts of the enterprise, and I've even said that maybe the person shouldn't argue with these people, but on the other hand, the oral historian is going to be creating the product. He's going to be the artist, or shaping it. And thus, the oral historian should know in advance what mission he or she wants to go out on. That doesn't mean you won't find some things you didn't expect. But when you go to the family reunion, mm-hmm. you should have in mind what it is about
the focus that
you want to recreate mm-hmm. with the events that take place. Is it having all the sisters in the family talk together, all the different units in the family talk together, all the people talk about the great-grandfather who's there, some...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every book that a person writes could be three or four different kinds of books from the same mm-hmm. material.
Depending on the perspective, yeah. depending on what you were trying to get at.
But that's the key word, Patty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the key word, is perspective. Oral history gives us those personal perspectives, and being able to capture them and put them within the bigger framework.
Mm-hmm.
is what this is about, and that's what you're doing, Jean.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, is when you go in and you say you have an idea of what you're going to do, I think one really important point is that the oral historian go in without a bias, realize I'm going to record what this person is saying. I'm not going to shape the interview mm-hmm. according to how I feel.
I know, but I think that's really impossible because, for example, one thing that I've learned by doing this show, uh-huh. I talk not only about bears and ducks, but hockey and a whole variety of things, gardening, some people's reminiscences of Fairbanks that deal with personal remembrances of their own history, and some with some famous people who have a field of expertise who may not even be from Fairbanks. My knowledge about those fields varies widely. My interest is always my perspective, and I think my doing an interview on hockey is going to be very different than someone who has played hockey for mm-hmm, 15 mm-hmm. years or is a very avid hockey fan. And I can't help that. I mean, I try to be neutral, and I try to bring out as much of what my guests have to say as possible, but it is going to be my perspective.
Of course it's going to be your perspective. The only thing you want to watch about is there's no sense in going in to interview a person and you've said in advance, I don't care what the person says, I don't like him and anything he's ever done.
Right.
And people would have those views about certain people in Alaska.
Right.
Now, there's no that mm-hmm. you curtail mm-hmm. your mm-hmm. usefulness by doing that. On the other hand, you've, as we've talked earlier, you've chosen
mm-hmm.
to interview a certain person because something they've done
right, but
does interest you.
Gene's project is far mm-hmm. more wide open
sure.
that way. You've had the choice of all those faces than yours, because mm-hmm. you have to interview everyone who has been documented to be involved in that process mm-hmm. of writing the Constitution, right? If there's someone here, you can't say, I don't want to talk to that person.
And of course, Jean runs the risk that though everyone is fascinating to her, what happens if all those people aren't fascinating in their four-hour rambles
oh, right.
to anybody else?
That's right. That's why I think that's why I have to make it fascinating, pull out
yeah.
of what it is to make it fascinating. That's why I don't know how valuable they're going to be to archives. I mean, I think that the finished product might be valuable, but the long
term. Well, then the archivist gets to make a judgment, right?
Yeah.
That's right, but I try to get in at the groundwork level, ground level, by making these great offers of great equipment, because at that stage I try to ensure that I've got enough information into the person who's going out so that they know that if it becomes deposited in the archives, it'll have to meet certain criterion. So I try to cultivate that. Now, whether it ends up, you know, as a successful contribution to the archives 5 years later is something that I bat about 100, I guess. And that's not very good in the major leagues. But can I comment on your interviewing technique a little bit, Patty?
Certainly. Here we go, folks. Criticize by an expert. I can take it.
No, I find you incredibly effective. You have the ability to listen and engage the person who you're asking a question, and at the same time to be thinking of how that relates to the other people in the room and to draw them in. And that's one of the reasons why I'm looking very carefully at your collection and hoping that we can make some arrangements to get some of those deposited in the archives, because you are getting that personal perspective.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice to hear.
Were you listening to the next question to ask somebody?
I'm speechless. Doesn't happen too often. Actually, I do think that that's something that makes this program and a lot of other discussions a success when it works, is that I am listening to what you're saying rather than coming in here with a list of prepared questions where I don't care what you've just said. I've got my next question on my agenda. But I do some thinking about it before I come into the studio. So I have some questions to fall back on sort of in my memory, but for me, my personal style is that if I come in with a paper with them all written out, it limits my capacity to hear what my guests are really saying to me.
That's how I approach mine, very much so. I mean, I don't go in with a list of questions about...
And that's why I really can respond to what you're saying, Bill, about going in not with a recorder the first time because of the concentration level that may be required of you if you know that it's not being backed up with this tape. It's amazing what you really can remember from an hour's conversation if you really concentrate. Obviously, you were concentrating when you were in with Bill Egan.
Oh, yeah, and often there is the danger of thinking, because it's on tape, I don't have to review it immediately. And then you go back and listen to it 3 or 4 months later, and you've lost a bit of the verve that was there with the interview, which you sometimes you write down more things immediately.
When you wrote down your memory, your immediate memory of that conversation with Bill Egan, did you put in the color? Did you put in the nonverbal reaction that he had? None of that, of course, ever gets
on the tape.
Yeah, for instance, this fountain pen discussion is great, John. I haven't heard that, and I plan to use that one.
See, and that would not have been recorded on a tape.
No, you know, the tape doesn't have anyone wistfully looking out the window or...
Well, it's one of the joys of a radio or any kind of audio experience that all the faces are not there for you, and you can imagine anything that you want, and it sort of objectifies it a little bit or detaches you. But I also feel sorry sometimes for my radio listeners that they aren't seeing the animated faces and the sort of facial reactions that people have in a conversation. You know, that also tells part of the tale, so to speak. So that is something that you wouldn't get if you weren't just there listening carefully. How do you teach your students, Bill, to do oral history? I mean, we've talked about some things that you need to bring to the process, but you teach a course, and presumably there are historians, some people interested in history, that say, well, I want to be an oral historian. What?
Well, yeah, and at some point, somebody make a mental note. We got to talk about soul, too, and investment of soul, okay? Would you make a mental note?
I'll make a mental note.
I do teach a formal course, Discovering the Literature of Oral History, and that's... We don't touch a tape recorder in that course. We read the best products that I can find that have been produced in written form using oral history as a methodology. And this is the first semester I taught it. I learned along with the students by reading the literature. And I may have enjoyed the course more than they did. My eyes are.
I don't think so, actually.
My eyes are falling out from reading. But I am. It's been the most exciting thing I've done all semester, in my professional life.
I know a couple of your students, and they are very invested in the lives of those people that they're studying. We meet on Tuesdays before they have a class, and they're sitting and they're talking about these people that they're studying in your class as if they are real friends. You know, what an interesting life so and so had, and the whole way they retell it. I read about a really interesting woman the other day, and then it is as if they are a friend. They are fleshed out in a way.
Well, that's really nice to hear. The other thing that I do is that I spend a lot of time sitting and listening and talking with people who roam into my office. And I am going to stop doing that because I don't think it's as effective as some other things that I might be doing. But as I say, I bat about 100. Every 1 out of 10 people who come into my office and I invest time in telling them about how they can get started, 1 out of 10 goes out and produces a product that's worthwhile. And there have been some wonderful products. Let's talk about some of the positive things.
Sure.
Connie Huffman did for the 99s that slide tape presentation on aviators in the North. Mm-hmm. And boy, she just did a honey of a job with old pictures and old tapes from the
archives.
Explain
in a little more detail who the 99s are.
The 99s is a women's aviation group that's national. I guess it's international in scope. And Connie did this for their meeting in Anchorage, which was at the beginning of the summer, and they packed the ballroom at the Captain Cook, and we put on this presentation. I was just in fear and trembling. And Connie carried it off. It was beautiful. It was a wonderful thing that she did. Jane Williams, who's a tremendous support system to Jean and to myself, has been working on the Circle Fairbanks Trail, and has been interviewing folks. My dear friend Doris Southall has been working with me on recording old-timers, particularly nurses and old folks in the area, and that's been very, very rewarding. We did an interview with old Doc Huffman just before he died, and Frank Young, and some other folks in town, and she keeps me going. She gets me out there on the street, and it's so important to get out there on the street. Is this a good time to talk about soul, Jean?
Sure. I think SBD is a good time. Oh, you want me to talk? Well, you go.
It was his mental note, but you were keeping it. You want to go first?
Well, I guess maybe soul is what you're talking about when you get out in the street, and it's what I'm talking about when I let somebody ramble for 4 hours. We were talking about the same thing. I want to find out about the essence of that person, not just the things he did, but that undefinable.
You invest soul when you develop a relationship with somebody to do a recording, and you're bringing all of your talents and all your perspectives, and you're asking that person to give of themselves. And for those of you out there that are interested in oral history, put the soul part into your interviewing process. But when it comes to dealing with the machines afterwards, whether it be the typewriter or the computer, or whether it is with the administration that's putting together the transcripts, take your soul out of it there, because maybe you'll find you don't have enough soul to go around, like I found, you know?
Because that's where you have to become the dispassionate professional, making more objective decisions. Mm-hmm. I think the interviewing process is something that, it's like counseling. They describe counseling, there are lots of techniques, but there's no content. The content is the personality of the two people in the experience. And you can have all the techniques in the world, and if you don't have yourself and your own experience and your own compassion to invest in that, it isn't necessarily a helping process. And
that's something Bill and I were talking about just before we came on. A certain amount of life experience on the part of the interviewer is essential. I think that somebody's going to tell a completely different story to someone in their 20s than they're going to tell them to someone in their 40s, because they are going to assume that you have an awareness of what life is about that you don't have when you're young. And I think that these, when you're talking about if you want to become an oral historian outside of your own family, of course, is that there are certain things that are really needed in that sense.
But how about curiosity? Doesn't that take you a long way?
Yes, I think it does. But curiosity on your part, I don't know if that's enough to get somebody else to tell you things about them that you want to know.
How are you reacting to that, John?
Well, there's one thing about the life experience you've said and some things we've said earlier. I don't think we should give people the impression that oral history is, there's anything about it that leads one to want to only interview older people. You could do an oral history of a high school.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, who knows who would be the best interviewer? Would it only be other high school students?
I would definitely think so.
Yes. Yeah.
No, this is a common research strategy in education or anthropology or whatever. We're interviewing a wide spectrum of people, whether it be children or adolescents or adults.
And how you view your life at 20 is very different from how you view your life at 40
I've
and
noticed
then at 60.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's interesting.
But another thing we get into, particularly when it's public events, and this is why some people get upset with oral history, is how reliable is what people are recording.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe if you're talking about how they've related to their children, maybe, I don't know if you're wondering, are they really telling me the truth or not? Or do they know the truth? Or is this a glossy, rosy view of what their life was?
Mm-hmm.
With the public aspect, people wonder, do they have an axe to grind? Are they telling me the whole story?
Mm-hmm.
And Bill and I and others who've talked about this find that there is no rule. I mean, oral interviews aren't necessarily rosier than what you'd find in written documents. I mean, there's no litmus test for every interview that says we have to discount this by a factor of 50%. It seems that people respond more, I don't know if you say more favorably or more honestly or what, to events that have not been marked with controversy and conflict, and that conflict may take place years after the event. For example, Alaska statehood has been fairly successful. There are very few people who say 25 years later, I wished we'd never done it. We're worse off.
Well, I know one.
You interviewed about four on your show. I remember those charmers. And
we want to get that tape.
What a group. People don't look, large groups of people don't look back on it with regret. On the other hand, I found in going to Hawaii that same openness is not there. Why? Because there's been a major revolution in the political party system. Republicans and Democrats in Hawaii are something definite. In Alaska, who's sure what they are?
Right.
They change parties like they change clothes. In Hawaii, there are party and partisan feelings.
Mm-hmm.
There are very strong ethnic feelings in Hawaii of which groups have won and which groups have lost. The economy in Hawaii has changed drastically since statehood. And not just that people are more prosperous, but that an agricultural way of life has given way to a tourist way of life.
They've really become connected with the rest of the world.
Yeah. And so when people sometimes remember the statehood movement in Hawaii, it's sometimes with an ambivalence of success and personal failures.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to do an oral history of the growth of an organization, if it's been characterized by a lot of personal victories for some and personal defeats for others, the oral history is going to be different than if it's generally been everyone involved has grown and profited.
Well, what you were saying earlier, I think the thing that struck me about your initial remarks was that really we need all of these things. We need the public documentation, but we also need the people who were living that experience, their reactions, and there's not going to necessarily be consensus.
Yeah,
I mean, we only know one thing about, or we only learn one aspect by the documentation of the McCarthy era. Then there's also the population's reactions to that. Something that's very interesting to me, I found some, Sam found some old magazines, some ladies' home journals from the wartime in a cabin a couple of years ago. And looking at the slant of those advertisements, the kind of language that's used, what the articles are saying, sort of surprises me. I mean, you know, it's real firm in my mind, the Pearl Harbor Day and so on, the documentation, the public events of what happened during the war, at least the highlights, but people's reactions to that is something additional, let's say.
That really speaks to the issue. Commander Libby, David Libby here in town, and I are working up a paper for the Fur Trade Conference, and we're going to talk about fur trapping on the North Slope from the standpoint of the people out there, the trappers. And that's a history that's been mostly written from the standpoint of the companies and the international movements. So we're going to hopefully bring in all those different personal perspectives. And again, that's where oral history is at its best.
I like oral history because it does tend to broaden the historian's view of a subject. I always a little bit wince when someone says, I've examined the official documents. With the sense that for some reason these are accurate or convey the truth, and that other forms of sources are less
legitimate.
I know no reason why I trust something that's in print any more than something that's on tape.
That's another thing you mentioned. How do we know that it's true? Well, presumably when you add all the little pieces together, you get some truth. This whole Westmoreland trial is fascinating from that aspect, that everyone has their version of what occurred, and we're going to presume for argument's sake that no one's lying, but
we need a folklorist to examine the themes.
Yeah.
I often think that in doing the people that I'm doing, that if I could expand it, or just as a fantasy, I'd like to do every member of that family and see if they came up with the same story or more or less the same feeling about what happened.
Well, is there reality?
It was interesting. How many people would admit that they failed in bringing up their children?
Oh, it's usually the children's fault, isn't it?
Well, I think how they admit that is by not mentioning it. It just doesn't come up.
Yeah. It's an omission.
That's right.
People acknowledge their failures but are not likely to tell you about them in their oral histories unless you extract that.
Depending on the person, of course.
And so you never know if something's omitted or did they just forget about it. But then you put in your own personal ideas of, oh no, a person does not forget about that. And of course, that's based on your sense of what's important.
Can I get in before we close here? If anyone's interested in doing oral history, my colleague Ron Inouye has developed a evaluation form. It might be titled, So You Want to Get Involved in Oral History. And it's a checklist of things that you may or may not have considered. And it gives you a good idea of the overall picture. And we're trying to keep track of those to see how people are prepared or unprepared and what they're thinking about in terms of final products.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is obviously a topic that fascinates me. I was really intimidated by the idea of having an hour show, and I have discovered that some of the best conversation occurs at the end, and I want to keep going, and so I suppose that's somewhat supportive, Gene, let the tape roll process. I hope that this has been as enjoyable for my audience as it has been for me. With me in the studio have been Gene Lester, John Whitehead, Bill Schneider. Next week I'm going to have a conversation with Gordon Wright and John Adams, and apparently we're not necessarily going to talk about music. Please join us for that. Our executive producer has been Carla Tonella. I hope you have a very happy weekend.
is KUAC-FM in Fairbanks. It's 12 noon.
Support for this program is provided by NPR member stations and the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, election coverage by AT&T, providing telephones, business information systems, and long-distance services, Mead Data Central for Nexus Research Services, and for international news coverage, the German Marshall Fund of the United States. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Washington, D.C., National Public Radio presents another in the continuing series of broadcasts from the National Press Club. I'm Frank Stacio, and today's guest speaker is Treasury Secretary Donald Regan.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is John Fogarty. I'm the Washington correspondent of the San Francisco Chronicle and president of the National Press Club. I'd like to welcome my fellow club members and their guests seated in the audience this afternoon, as well as those of you who are listening to this program over the 303 National Public Radio stations or watching over the 1,800 cable systems affiliated with C-SPAN, the Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network. Before going any further, I'd like to remind our members of some coming events. Due to circumstances beyond our control, the luncheon which we had scheduled for the new Senate Majority Leader, Bob Dole, has had to be postponed. We're going to try to reschedule it as soon as we possibly can. On Wednesday, December 5th, our luncheon speaker will be World Bank President A.W. Clausen, who will offer his global economic outlook. Also scheduled this month are Bill Bradley, Senator from New Jersey. He'll be here on Tuesday, December the 11th. Senators David Durenberger of Minnesota and Dennis DeConcini of Arizona on Thursday, December 13th. And on Monday, December 17th, our luncheon speaker will be Representative Jack Kemp of New York. As far as I know, we're not going to have any luncheon on Christmas. I'd like to remind you in the audience, and some of you are already familiar with the drill or doing it, if you have any questions of our speaker, please send them up to me, and I will ask as many as time allows. Please write as clearly or print as clearly as you can. Sometimes a question doesn't get asked simply because I can't read it. I'd now like to introduce the guests at our head table. One other point. There will be texts of the speech available at the end of the speech, and you can pick them up on your way out. There was a word processing malfunction that put some wrong figures in. At least they think it was the word processor. It would have been sabotage. Who knows? I'd like to introduce the guests at our head table, ask our guests to please stand briefly when their names are read. Also ask you in the audience to withhold your applause until I've read all the names. Starting at my left, Steve Nordlinger, Baltimore Sun, David Rosenbaum, New York Times, Paul Bluestein, Wall Street Journal, Steve Beckner, Washington Times, and a member of the Speakers Committee who organized today's luncheon, Ron Perlman, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Tax Policy, Mrs. Donald Regan, wife of our speaker, Judy Grandy, Cleveland Plain Dealer and the chairperson of the NPC Speakers Committee, Alfred Kingen, Assistant Secretary for the Treasury for Policy, Planning, and Communications, Ben Weberman, Economics Editor, Forbes Magazine, Sally Jacobson, Associated Press, Steve Ogg, ABC News, Linda Stern, Journal of Commerce, and Mike Gelb of Reuters. Our speaker today is Treasury Secretary Donald T. Regan. He was born December 21st, 1918 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he majored in English and economics at Harvard. Now, those are two fields I've always thought were contradictory. Reagan's entire business career was spent with Merrill Lynch, the nation's largest stock brokerage firm. He joined the company in 1946 as an account executive and rose to chairman and chief executive officer in 1971. He left that post in 1981 to become the nation's 66th Treasury Secretary. Now, Secretary Reagan has never worked for E.F. Hutton. But the other day, when Reagan unveiled the Treasury Department's long-awaited tax reform plan, people, lots and lots of people, in business, industry, and government, listened. So far, Secretary Reagan's tax plan is kind of in the position of a struggling Broadway play. Good reviews, but no lines at the box office. House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dan Rostenkowski praised the tax plan as, quote, very forward-looking, but withheld his support for it because the proposal would not reduce the deficit. Rostenkowski's views are shared by others on the Hill, including Republican leaders in the Senate. Meanwhile, downtown, the real power structure, those who feed the city's movers and shakers, our restaurateurs, are just plain hostile to the plan's limits on business meal deductions. Now, if you don't think that the restaurant industry has clout, you apparently have forgotten what happened to former President Carter's proposal to eliminate deductions for the three martini lunch. The restaurant industry is just one of those who feel its ox is being gored by the tax plan. Others, including state governments, have been heard from, or you can bet will be soon. Throughout all of this, the nation's number one taxpayer, President Reagan, has kept his views of the tax plan and deficit reduction to himself. It is now a pleasure for me, having spun this web, to yield the podium to our speaker, who will take the bull by the horns, so to speak, and sort all of this out for you. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome the Treasury Secretary, Donald Reagan.
Thank you, John. I'll respond to that in a moment, that introduction, but first let me acknowledge the distinguished members of the head table, my wife, also the members of the press club and their guests. It is a pleasure for me to be here. John, we may not have a box office smash as yet, but we certainly have a bestseller. I noticed the line is long, and we ran out of our first printing. We're into our second printing, which is more than some of you authors can say about your works. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I read that by not changing his cabinet nor the senior staff, that President Reagan was, I guess you'd actually say, condemning his second term to a case of tired blood. We supposedly were out of fresh ideas, that nothing new would be proposed, and obviously Congress was going to have to do it all. Well, now after the first revelation of the possibility of more detailed arms talks with the Soviets,